telemetry isn't an excuse for poor falconry.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that you can fly your bird when it's fat because you have telemetry, because you'll be able to find it. That's a, you know, it's basically, I think, drones and telemetry and all the new modern gadgets for the new generation of falconers have created sloppy falconry. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the very first episode of the Wilderness Wonders Podcast. My name is Jason Norman. I am a falconer and wildlife educator. For this episode, I had the wonderful opportunity to sit down and chat with Steve Chingren. Steve Chingren has been doing falconry for over 60 years, and he has really specialized in long wings or larger falcons. Particularly, he enjoys hunting sage grouse in the sage deserts of Wyoming. And he has perfected the art of hunting this very difficult quarry with his falcons. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's get into it. All right, well, welcome to the Wilderness Wonders Podcast. This is my very first episode, so I am a little bit nervous.
Don't be nervous.
Well, not only that, is you're one of my, you know, falconry heroes, I feel like, too. So,
well, that's sad.
No, not at all. I don't think so. You've got so much experience and just amazing stories and information to share. But anyways, this is Steve Chingren. I am hanging out here at the House of Grouse for a couple days. We've just barely finished up watching, we watched your falcons fly today, your three.
Kind of a windy day. Wasn't real good, but we had some fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But do you mind introducing yourself?
Yep.
Real quick?
Yeah, Steve Chingren, and I've been doing falconry for over 60 years and started as a young child with an interest in wildlife and just loved anything that was wild, and had a chance encounter with a hawk and looked up hawks and learned about falconry and decided I wanted to do it, but there was no way to learn about it when mm-hmm. I was a child because there was no internet, there was no Googling anything. You just went to every library and hoped that there was a book on falconry in it, which there never was. And so it was a long journey to even find any kind of information and to scratch the surface on how to get into the sport, and a lot more difficult than it is today.
Yeah. What sparked your interest in wildlife or birds of prey?
I think lots of young kids are interested in nature, and just naturally they love being in the outdoors and they like going camping, and they mm-hmm. like, you know, most kids, like when they're growing up at a certain age, get a at least I did, they loved I loved reptiles and dinosaurs, and that's kind of how I got started. As a, you know, I just thought those things were really interesting, you know. Mm-hmm. The natural history was interesting, and museums and things like that talked. I loved natural history museums when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I loved birds and Audubon and all that kind of stuff. So falconry seemed like, when I saw that you could get a bird and train it to hunt, I thought it seemed like the perfect relationship. And when I saw that, as a young child, I decided that's what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I pretty much pursued falconry throughout my life. And I started off with Cooper's hawks and red-tailed hawks and kestrels, and basically had them as pets because where I lived didn't have anywhere to hunt them. But I flew them.
Yeah, where did you live?
Like, I lived in the canyons, in the mountains, and I would let my hawks fly around the house and stuff, and they stayed around. And my red-tailed hawk would actually catch soars and go over the mountains, and I'd just think I'd never see him again. And you know, several days later, he'd be back sitting in his favorite tree at the end of the yard. And I had that red-tailed hawk all through my grade school years growing up, and it was quite a relationship that I had with that bird, and I was very fond of it. And then I finally learned how to make jesses, and you know, when I first had that red-tailed hawk, I didn't have any jesses on it. And so when I finally got jesses on it, boy, that really just made the flavor of falconry come to life. And it's like, you know, the sound of bells and the smell of leather and all these things that you know, drive you to have this incredible interest in this sport that is hard to explain. Just smelling your bird's feathers and just, you know, the relationship that you have with the bird is something that's difficult to explain to someone who's not into it.
It's crazy how all your senses can kind of really remember what falconry feels like. And yeah. And then when every day when you go out practicing it or spend some time with your bird, a lot of those memories that you have, or even of your first encounters, at least for me, my first encounters haven't been that long ago, but they still kind of come back.
And you like, that's why I say, like, my favorite raptor is the American Kestrel, because mm-hmm. that was the very first bird that I ever had, and they were just so incredibly beautiful, and they're the most beautiful bird in North America, and they're just such lovely beautiful falcons, and
they're
just
so adorable.
The personality is so wonderful that they're still my favorite falcon. But currently I hunt with falcons, and I've been hunting with falcons since I was 16. Started with prairie falcons, and of course when I learned falconry, there was no telemetry, there were no drones or anything like that. And today we have a whole different generation of people where they, you know, there was no catalog falconry where you could just go online and order anything you needed, like a perch or, you know, gloves or jesses. Nowadays you can go online, there's several falconry suppliers all over the world, there's falconry suppliers, you can just go buy whatever you want. When I did it, you had to learn how to make it all yourself, and every falconer in those days learned how to make their own hoods and make their own jesses and
gloves too.
I didn't make my own gloves, but I usually found a welder's glove or something.
Oh yeah, welding gloves work great. Yeah,
we used those. So I never made gloves, but I made hoods and jesses and got, you know, and my road to falconry began with prairie falcons, and we went through the era when there was no peregrine falcons because of DDT, and they were gone. There were times in Utah when prairie falcon eyries, you'd go to the prairie falcon eyries, and there weren't any prairies either. There was like one eyes in the eyries, and mm-hmm. it was really hard to find a prairie eyrie. And there was a time in, I would say, the early 70s where they seemed like their numbers were really low. But anyway, we found them, and we got them, and we flew them. We flew eyeses and passages, and you know, learned how to make our own degausses and trap with degausses, and it's mainly what we use for trapping for prairie falcons mm-hmm. was degausses and a starling.
When did you start getting other than like the Kestrel that you first had?
I got my first prairie falcon in 1967, I think it was.
Okay.
And then I graduated high school in 1970, and I got my first After I got the prairie falcon fluid, I wanted to get a peregrine, so I got trapped a peregrine and flew it, and then I wanted to get a deer falcon. And back then there was no captive breeding, so there was not even an option of ever thinking about mm-hmm. getting one from a breeding project. The only way you got one is to get one from the wild, and the only people that ever had deer falcons, that's how they got them. They got them from the wild, so I decided I wanted a deer falcon, and I went and got one.
And, did you only go for passages then too?
No,
I
got an IS.
Oh, okay.
And I flew it for 7 years, and you know, then it eventually got electrocuted on a power pole. But I've been flying long wings pretty much my entire career in falconry. I've never caught a rabbit. And I don't really, it's just not my cup of tea, hawking hawks.
Today, rabbit hawking seems to be like what just about everybody's doing. It's
you know, a whole different thing. It's a whole different thing than flying long wings, though. It's a whole different
ball game.
It's a different thing. The flying long wing, I think, is a little more of a commitment, because you actually have to have a bird do a trained behavior in order to hunt. It has to wait mm-hmm. on. It has to wait on, and when it flies a mile and a half away, it has to know to come back and find you, and these types of things, you know, and that's the thing I've noticed. What I've seen people coming out here recently and using the new technology, you know, people have GPS and they have drones and they train the birds with a drone. Well, I don't think a drone has anything to do with training. All a drone has to do with is conditioning your bird. And it's like, you know, you use the drone when you're not training mm-hmm. to exercise your bird for pure exercise. It's nothing to do with training mm-hmm. Because people that train their birds to the drones, they think they can wean them off a drone, and that's not going to teach a bird to wait on. If you train a bird to a drone and you think you're going to hunt it, you're going to complicate the task 10 times by training it with a drone first. Yeah. You probably won't even catch anything its first season. But if you take and train a bird like they trained them for centuries to wait on, by letting the falcon know that you're flushing game for it, and you get to see what kind of falcon you have. A drone, any bird will go up to a drone, but you can get a falcon that will fly incredible or not so incredible. And you're looking for the ones that fly really good. So if you use a drone, you don't know. You don't know if you got one of those really good falcons, because they all go up and get the bait off the drone. But if you get a bird that we used to call a natural, that's one that flew just how you wanted to fly for falconry. It climbed high in the sky. When it took off the fist, it was a certain things you would look for. You wouldn't want a bird that flies low across the ground. You wanted the birds that when they left the fist started to climb into the sky immediately on their own. This was with no drone. Some of the highest flying falcons I had throughout my career were before any of this other technology, kites, balloons, or drones existed. And the birds I trained with traditional methods flew higher than the birds I'm flying now, or just as high. But I've had the birds I'm flying right now, I had birds that flew higher with just natural training without using any of these devices. And these devices basically originated from people who lived in areas where they could not fly a bird because they had too much check, which if you don't know what check is, that means wild other quarry that the birds would go after. So if they tried to train the bird and they used pigeons to train the bird, there was too many pigeons living in the area where they were training. Once the birds got to where they liked pigeons, then the bird would just be off chasing pigeons in the city every day. So they could use kites, balloons, and drones and be able to fly their birds in an area where there was other quarry that without introducing the birds to that quarry, and they could still fly a bird.
They
keep the bird fit and focused on going up to the drone.
But it kind of spoils
the kite.
Hunting spoils.
That's not how I train my birds. I train my birds still with the traditional methods. And what I see the problem is with flying with drones, anybody that comes up here, I can tell immediately when they want to go out there and fly their bird, and they've flown it to drones. It may go up, but it's kind of like all over the sky. It doesn't really know what it's doing. And then as soon as it chases a grouse off, it doesn't come back and look for you because it's never been trained to return for another flush because it doesn't understand that you're putting up quarry for it. So generally, birds that are trained to drones or kites or balloons, once they chase the quarry off, they just end up getting lost and flying out through the desert. Well, if this would have been ancient times, that bird would be gone. You would never see it again. But today we have GPS, and so falconers have assurance they can always go find their bird, which is made for really sloppy, poor falconry. And I see really bad falconry, and I tell people, God, every time I fly my bird, I'm losing it. I have to go track it and find it.
Take the telemetry off of it.
Train it. Train the bird. Telemetry should be an insurance that your beloved bird, should it get lost because of some fluke accident or because it killed something and you can't find it, it allows you to find it. Telemetry isn't an excuse for poor falconry. And it doesn't mean that you can fly your bird when it's fat because you have telemetry because you'll be able to find it. It's basically, I think, drones and telemetry and all the new modern gadgets for the new generation of falconers have created sloppy falconry.
They're using it too much as a crutch.
It's sloppy falconry. It's not good falconry.
That is unfortunate. I have noticed, though, that the most successful falconers, no matter what bird they're flying, is when they gain that bird's trust, they get that bird on game as soon as possible. Yeah. And that makes a good bird pretty quick.
Yeah, that's what falconry is hunting wild quarry. And that's difficult. And that's why I understand people that have birds and still want to have the relationship with a bird and fly it and being able to go out and balloon and kite and drone. And if you don't have an area where there's anything to hunt, at least you're out getting to have that experience and watching your bird. My birds, I could drone my birds. I do drone my birds, and I use drones for exercise. But I don't ever serve my bird off the drone. I hear people talking, I've got to wean it off the drone. Well, the drone's just a tool for exercise. I never serve my birds any mm-hmm. bagged quarry or something when they're up off of a drone. And something that I have seen starting to happen is people using drones actually in hunting to get their bird up, like over a pond, and then flushing for it. I think that's just...
So like they'll try to get their bird in position using a drone and
then flush something? Yeah, they'll just put the drone up over the pond, or they'll want to put a drone up and then try and flush game when the bird's going up to the drone, and they get the drone up real high. So the bird, you know, kind of like they can burn it off of the drone and then flush game for it. And, you know, but to me,
the drone doesn't flush the ducks.
That's pathetic. No, they don't.
No, it doesn't?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, not
I think the loud drone would.
Not if it's 400 feet before it goes over the pond.
Okay, that's true.
So it's like if an airplane flies over at 500 feet, the ducks don't flush out the pond.
That's true.
Or a helicopter. They don't mind a drone, you know, so. But I've seen it happen. People are doing it more and more. And I would like to see people not do that. I think probably in some states it's illegal to use drones in hunting. Mm-hmm. And to me, it ruins the romance of falconry, mm-hmm. you know. And like even now, a lot of people aren't, and even me, I don't use bells anymore because I've got so much gear on my bird, I don't want to weight it down anymore by putting the bell on it because I have two transmitters on it. But mm-hmm. you know, in the old days, to listen to the tinkling bell in the sky and you know, part of falconry is being out there in the early morning and hearing the sounds of the wild and hearing the wing beat of your bird pumping up in the sky. And you know, you certainly don't want a big giant buzzing drone up in there. You know, it's like
what really blew me away today was when your falcon would dive and you'd hear that really loud
zzzz. They rip the air.
Yeah. Oh yeah. My gosh.
That whenever a bird's coming in from over 500 feet or more, you know, they usually make an audible hiss, and the higher they are, so the louder cool. the hiss. And so a stoop from, you know, over 1,000 feet really makes a lot of noise, and it's cool to hear. Yeah. But you know, I would like to encourage people to still keep some of the art of falconry intact. Don't let technology completely ruin this ancient art of training mm-hmm. birds, where people had to figure out how to do things and make them do things. And you know, it's like, you know, these things can be used to make your falconry better, but they can be overused. And so remember, telemetry is insurance to not lose your birds. You know, so if you're finding your bird with telemetry more than three times, you better rethink what you're doing. You know, if your bird's flying away and you're using telemetry to go find it, it's not coming and finding you, because falcons will come and find you. If they're trained mm-hmm. properly, they can go miles away and they have a better sense of direction than we do. And you just set your ground and they'll come back to you. And that's what's nice about the GPS units nowadays, because you don't have to, the old telemetry, you'd kind of panic if your bird was, you lost track of the signal, you'd go out there. But the GPS will show you that the bird's, you know, maybe out 2 miles, but it's turning and it's coming back, and mm-hmm. and you can see it coming back, and that's a real peace of mind, and mm-hmm. you know, you make better decisions. And so the GPS is nice, but still, it's something to monitor and see what your bird's doing. It's not something to just recover a bird, because if you're recovering your bird with telemetry all the time, your bird isn't trained. You know, it's not trained. You shouldn't even be flying it unless you get it trained. Where
I mean, that's even how my red-tailed hawk acts.
Yeah.
She I mean, if she flies off, if she's seeing game, and she'll start chasing rabbits here and there, but if there's nothing showing up
comes
for a
back,
bit,
come back,
she comes
yeah.
right
yeah.
back to me.
That's
yeah.
falconry, you know. Falconry, yeah. But with long wings, it's
yeah,
you know,
mine's not flying nearly
they're
as
not
far.
Going quite, the distance is quite as much.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of speaking when I talk about this, you know, and I don't know that they use any of this stuff for flying, you know, rabbits with goshawks and Harris hawks mm-hmm. and red tails. I don't think that people really use drones. And some people use telemetry just as an insurance to make sure if the bird catches something somewhere and they didn't see where it caught it, they can locate where it is on the kill. And that's really what a telemetry is. It's what bells were for, is basically mm-hmm. to you know, be able to look up in the sky and see where your bird was.
For me, the bell helps me know where to find my bird after
right.
she catches
she's
a rabbit.
Kill, you hear yeah. the bell, and makes it, and especially if they should, you know, go off a ways. But in the old days, you know, falconers relied on things by watching magpies and crows and ravens and other hawks. If your bird had a kill and it was a way off, you could locate it by sitting on a hill and observing what the rest of the wild critters were doing, because other bird would find your hawk on a kill, because when a bird's on a kill, stuff finds it because they want to get in on the kill. So
a rough leg had found your falcon today.
Yeah, today a rough leg was on my falcon when we got there. But you know, and so if we hadn't had the GPS to be able to track to my bird, we would have had to like go up on a hill and just watch. And if we saw a rough leg hawk come in and circle around, that would tell us that he's circling around my bird on a kill, and we would know right where it was.
Yeah, that was really cool. I thought that was a really neat example of, this is what you'd look for without, your
telemetry. But I just want this new generation of falconer to know that if you're flying a long wing, a drone isn't the answer to training your bird. Mm-hmm. A drone is just a conditioning tool, and I don't even like using them, but and in fact, I haven't had mine out for quite a while now, that since I've been just hunting every day. But it does, when you hunt a lot and over hunting dogs, the falcons will get to where, it depends on the falcon, but most falcons, if you've had them for a number of years, they usually fly really high the first, two or three years. But once they really get into the program and they get into being five, I have a bird that's four and a bird that's eight and a bird that's 15, they know what's going on. Yeah. They know what pitch works best to catch the grouse from, and generally it's about 700 feet is where they want to be. But the falconers, they want it to be higher because we like seeing that spectacular mm-hmm. stoop. So that's where I can take the drone and just not hunt the birds for a few days, or take and just drone them to great heights. And when you do that repetitively, it gets them in the habit of pumping up into the sky, and they kind of get out of the hunting habit for a while. And so it increases their pitch when you go back to hunting. But the more you hunt, the more they get locked into where it works best for them. Yeah. So it's a nice tool to use to be able to get your birds to fly a little bit higher. But it doesn't always work with every bird. And some birds, the drone won't ever make them fly higher. They just don't even ever grasp that concept, but it works with the birds I'm flying right now. And mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm rambling a lot here, but
no, it's no problem.
I just kind of want the younger generation to realize, read some of the old falconry books, know how they did it, know the traditional methods of training birds, and learn, sit down and make a hood, make your own jesses. It's not that hard. You don't have to buy everything. And it's rewarding to know how to make your own stuff, and it isn't hard to do.
I'd agree with that. I'd made the first hood I have is one that I made, and I've made my anklets, my jesses, my leash. I mean, the only two things I think I hadn't made was my giant hood and glove. Yeah. Everything else I've made. Even my falconry vest. I didn't like other falconry vests, so I added a pouch in the back.
And that's part of it's fun. It's fun to make your own equipment.
Yeah, I think it's
like that.
It's
but anyway, that's just my little plug on, trying to help. I don't want to see anybody, if somebody comes up here to hawk with me and they want to say, well, can I put my drone up before I, when you call your dog off the point, can I put my drone up and get my bird up higher over the bird? I won't allow it. I'll just say, no, if you're going to train your bird to the drone, let's go train your bird to the drone. And then when you've got your bird trained, if you're trying to hunt it and you're using the drone to get it go up to hunt it, you haven't trained it. All you've done is flown it to a drone. It's just flying it to a drone. Mm-hmm. And the bird knows nothing about waiting on or hunting. And so really, you need to understand how to train a falcon to wait on and do it in the methods that they used to use. Mm-hmm. And there's some people that would disagree with me that you can train them. But I've seen those people's birds fly, and I say the minute they chase a grouse, they're lost flying out across the desert. If they didn't have telemetry on them, that bird would just be gone. In the old days, we didn't have telemetry, and we had to train our birds to where they came back to us.
Yep.
And if we lost them, then we relied on the falconry community to go out in the area where it was lost, and everybody would get out there at first light and swing lures and finally get the bird to call in. And we had a really tight-knit community that everybody helped everybody, and we easily got the birds back. And if you read about the old days when, the falconers were out, there'd be a falconer perched on, if the king's falcon was lost, he'd have one of his falconers on every hill swinging a lure. And they would swing the lure for days until they got that favorite falcon back. And I've done the same thing. I've gone where a falcon's been lost, where it's made a kill and fed up and didn't have telemetry on it and couldn't find it. And, the next day you go out and swing the lures and they aren't coming in because they got full crops.
And that is dedication.
And you go out day after day after day and you set yourself a goal of, after I don't have my bird back in 7 days of going out there in mm-hmm. different areas swinging the lure, then I'll give up, or even longer. I used to set goals when I'd lose a bird that, you know, I'm not gonna quit looking, and you know, until I lost a Passage Prairie, for example, and I trapped it when I got this Passage Prairie. I trapped it off a high steel tower. So I decided when I lost it, this is before telemetry, that I was gonna get that prairie back. And I decided, I set myself a goal, and I got myself a notebook, and I says, when I've found 50 wild prairies and thrown the lure out for 50 wild prairies, and if my bird doesn't come in and within 50, then I'll give up. So I'd go out every day and I'd see a prairie and I'd write, there's one, and we're, and I'd get out and, you know, call. Wow. And I was using a pigeon, and actually I was on my like 12th prairie falcon when I got my bird back.
Wow.
So I'd take the spotting scope, good. And I'd go down the steel towers, and if there was a prairie on it, I'd try and call it in. And on the 12th prairie, I got my bird back, and my bird, I had so to trap cool. it back because it was still pretty wild. It got pretty wild again.
Oh, really? So how long did that take you to get that prairie back?
It took me like 4 days.
And it was already reverting back to its kind of like,
yeah, back
more
to
wild.
Yeah, being a wild bird.
That is so interesting. I feel like that's a big concern, because a lot of, or at least with the general community, is a lot of falconers love trapping wild passage birds, and yeah. a lot of us love to release their birds. Like I plan to release mine in a couple of years, and love to return her to the wild, and it's neat to know that these birds of prey will kind of revert and become more wild if just left alone.
Yeah.
I never got into it.
I always enjoyed trapping, but I know that some people do more trapping than they do falconry. And
trapping's so much fun for me.
I know, it's fun.
There's an appeal for some people.
Trapping should be a means to get your bird for falconry. It should be something that you'd... There's some people that is their falconry, is trapping birds.
I enjoy helping out some apprentice falconers, getting their first bird and seeing the light in their eyes, and they get so stoked. And I get so excited for them, too. Yeah. There are probably going to be quite a few people listening or watching that aren't into falconry at all. And maybe they're really interested in getting into falconry and want to fly long wings. Long wings are just, you know, falcons, like your peregrines and prairies and such. But what advice would you want to give to those people thinking about wanting to get into
falconry?
Well,
in today's world, in order to be a falconer, it's difficult to do it in urban areas. There's some types of, you know, like flying birds you can fly, you know, Merlins and Kestrels and Cooper's Hawks and things like that in urban settings where you can find quarry suitable for them to hunt. But for the type of falconer I do, which is hunting wild, you know, ducks and grouse and pheasants and partridge and things, you need to have the place to do it. And so basically I would say, if you're thinking about getting a falconry, look at where you live, know what kind of game and quarry you have around where you are, and see if it's even feasible to do falconry there, you know. And falconry isn't like gun hunting. You just don't put you can't put the falcon hawk away. And it takes extreme dedication to get the birds to be successful. You've got to go out and fly your bird and get it strong, because it's competing against wild animals. And so in order to be able to succeed at catching wild quarry, your bird really needs to be in the shape of a wild bird. And so you're going to become a bit of a slave to that bird to get it to that point.
I think a lot of these birds think that they're training you.
I do think that there's a high percentage of falconry, the people call themselves falconry, that really aren't falconers as far as doing it the way that I think it should be done. But who says that I'm right? But, you know, a lot of people, you know, refer to those people as pet keepers because they don't really get out and fly the birds. But really, you know, we don't try to encourage that type of falconry, because we don't think these birds make pets, even though we love our birds and they're very important to us. But they're different than like having a parrot in your house, or it's not an animal that should be kept as a pet. It needs to fly and be out and be wild, and that's part of their nature. And you know, people do breed them in captivity and have them in pens and things, and they, you know, and it's like, you know, who's to say what's right and what's wrong? You know, if someone has a hawk and they keep it in their falconry conditions on jesses and perches and in a mews, but they don't ever fly it, but they read falconry books and they dream about flying it. Well, that hawk's still out of the wild. But to me, I say if you're going to do it, be committed to the bird and give it a life that would be one that it would, you know, have if it was somewhat of a wild bird, where it actually experiences.
Get him out. Get him flying.
Let him be out there and be almost like a wild bird, and let you be the observer of that. That's what falconry is. It's watching, training a bird so that it will hunt in your presence, and you can go out and see that every day. A lot of times, somebody will see a hawk in the wild swoop down and make a kill or do something, and they'll always remember that, and they'll think that was so cool. I they'll see a peregrine when they're at Lake Powell come chase a blackbird, and the blackbird will fly under their boat, and the peregrine will throw up and fly over. And these people have no interest in falconry. They see something like that, and they'll just never forget it. Yeah. That's the thing about falconry, is that you can duplicate seeing what happens in nature with a hawk every day by training a bird to hunt with you.
That's kind of like when I brought my dad out for the first time, my first hawk caught. His first cottontail. I brought my dad out, and he was just like, "This is the coolest thing I've ever seen. This is like, this just blows my mind. Way like I would never see this anywhere else in the world." Yeah. And he thought it was just so incredible.
It is cool.
I wish he could come out today.
My advice to someone getting into falconry is make sure you have the time and the money and this place to do it
and the commitment.
You got to have a place to do it, and you can't be lazy. You know,
you can't get discouraged either.
You got to be able to get out there and do it. And it's not an easy thing to do, and it takes a lot of commitment. And so that's why people that know how to do it sometimes quit, because they know they can't do it halfway because it's not right. So if you're going to get into falconry, it's something you know, and that's people want to talk to me. Well, I'd really like to get into falconry. What do I think I need to do? And I go, the bottom line is, you have to look at it and make the commitment that you're going to do this. And that when you look at what kind of commitment is, most people, that's what stops them from doing it. And even falconers that have gotten out of it and want to get back into it, they know the commitment and they want to do it, but they're afraid to make the commitment again.
Mm-hmm. I agree. That can be really, really tough to dedicate that time. It takes an enormous amount of time to get a bird hunting really well, and for it to even just be fair for the bird.
Yeah, it's a bit of a lifestyle being a falconer, and it's more so than other hobbies, because it's you're dealing with a live animal that you're training, and it's a wild animal. Basically, they don't all come from the wild. Yeah. Some are captive bred, but they have that wildness in them and their in their genetics and what they want to do.
They don't act like pets.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
No. So
yeah, because they're not probably the most affectionate ones are maybe an older Harris's that really likes their falconer, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
That's all I've seen.
Yeah.
But that affection only comes like during the mating season.
And well, any imprint bird will, you know, treat you if they're mate
that
as
way.
A mate.
I wanted to ask a little bit more about your training with your dog compared to training your falcons.
First of all, for getting a dog to do, I the dog I have right now, I got from a breeder in Salt Lake City, Steve Tate, and he makes some really nice dogs. And what really, you know, if you get a good bred dog, or get a good hunting dog, it's bred for hunting. It's got the genes in it, and to do what they do it naturally. So basically, what you need to do is just get them into the hunting routine every day, to where they start to figure out what you want them to do. And as soon as they figure out what you want them to do, then they do it, and they want to please you. And so really, people ask who trains my dogs, and I just say it's a guy named Gene Poole.
Gene Poole. All right.
So you get a good.
You'll have to give me
a good hunting. Get a good hunting dog, and then the trick is, you know, and even a good hunting dog won't ever become a good hunting dog unless you get into birds. Mm-hmm. It usually takes. If you get a puppy, you're looking at a 3-year project before you're really hunting over it with falcons.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes when you're getting a dog, it takes a while to kind of enter them in with your
falcon. Yeah, because they don't know what's going on. They got a lot of run in them, you know. They get used to the falcons because you have them around the falcons all the time at home, and you introduce them to the falcons when they're puppies, and they'll get a real appreciation for them because the falcons, if a puppy comes up to them on a kill, a falcon will reach out and bite it or foot it, and the puppy will learn right away that that's not the cool thing to do. Mm-hmm. And dogs adapt to hunting with falconry really quickly, and the only times that I think there would be a danger if you got an older dog that had been trained with gun hunting to retrieve, and if your bird went down and took something down, the dog may go try and retrieve your falcon. And so you wouldn't want to do that. You'd want to make sure that the dog you got was around the falcons long enough to understand that the falcon is not something that we're after. Mm-hmm. It's part of the hunt. And once they get into that whole routine, they hunt with the falcon. Like my dog, you know, he comes back, we call him off the point, and he runs back and he just waits at the truck till we get the falcon up and till I tell him to go back out and point the grouse, and he runs back out and points him. But that works well because it takes all the pressure off of the situation, because you don't have the grouse flush prematurely when the bird's mm-hmm. not at pitch.
Yeah, so it seems like with the dog is more about pleasing you, but then when your falcons are out there, the falcons are more about pleasing their stomach.
Yeah, they don't care. The falcon, you're the coach, and so you're the one that's going to try and develop the style in your bird. Your bird just wants to eat.
Yeah.
And he doesn't care too much about style, but if you have the right falcons, and they, you know, and you train them correctly, then you mm-hmm. develop the style for them to hunt. Because my falcons, if I were to unhood them in a grouse flush, they'd take off right off the fist and they'd fly it out of sight. Mm-hmm. You know, and they might catch it, you know, because they're super confident that they can catch these things. Later in the year, when the grouse get really tough, they it's a little harder for them to do that.
How come they get harder to catch as it gets later in the year?
The grouse in the fall are young. They're molting. They're also dehydrated because they have to go to water to drink every day, and digesting the sage is really difficult for them in hot, warm weather. And so they have to have water. But in the wintertime, they eat snow and sage, and they're evenly hydrated all the time. And they get really super condition
back.
And really strong, and all their feathers are in, and they start to make longer flights daily. They get in groups and they flock up, and they do that for protection against predators. And when one bird in the group flushes, they all flush and they get up and fly around, and so they get a lot of flying, and they get stronger in the winter. And it's like a totally different animal, a grouse from October. And a grouse after December 21st, there's no comparison. And
do you see
falconers up here hunting them in the fall? They all come in September, October, and I do too. I love hawking them in September. That's my favorite time to hunt them because the flights don't go so far, and the grouse still flush clean and take a hit, and so you get really nice flights, but you just don't get the long tail chases where you have the problems with eagles killing your birds. And that's what happens. The later you get in the winter, the farther away the grouse fly if the bird doesn't knock it down and hurt it. And they're hard for them to knock down and hurt. They're very, very strong, powerful birds.
That's awesome. So you feel like your falcons get better as the year goes on, or?
Sometimes not. You have to be a judge. I'm flying tiercels, and like today you saw that, you know, my deer peregrine is 800 grams, and that cock sage grouse was, you know, over 2,500 grams. Mm-hmm. So it's so much bigger than him, you know, and they can get discouraged on it when they get really strong. And if you're not having a certain level of, you have to kind of capitalize on success. So if your bird catches one, you know, you may want to, when you get later in the year, you may not want to give it, you know, a pretty good feed, and maybe not try and catch one the next day. With capitalize on the success, you have to be really careful. Mm-hmm. If your bird starts missing them, if it misses one 3 days in a row, I think I'd quit. I'd go hunt ducks or something.
You want
its confidence up there. Yeah. You can't let them get beat every day after day after day on these things, or they'll just quit chasing them. Once they get that in their mind, got a real problem, because it's really hard to overcome that problem. Yeah, they just have to be. They have to keep a certain level of success in order to keep that mental confidence.
Mm-hmm.
the mental confidence. It's like you see it in a great athlete like Michael Jordan. When he comes into a game, he's quite sure he's going to win the game. And that's how your falcon has to look at every hunt.
Yeah.
He has to have that mental confidence. And that's where coaching as the falconer comes into play with the bird. You're developing the bird's mind. And your whole relationship with the bird has an effect on that. If you steal from your bird, if your bird doesn't trust you, if your bird mantles from you, if your bird tries to carry, all those things are showing you that the bird doesn't trust you and you've not got a good relationship with your falcon.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the types of things that takes years to work and learn. But a good falconer, if you have a bird that's doing things that, you know, like mantling and trying to, you know, being, you know, you can correct all these things, but that's what the art of falconry is you go out every day and you figure it out and you learn how to handle them in a way that, you know, keeps them in perfect feather and keeps them happy and they look at you as a hunting partner and not as someone who's like, you know, ripping food away from them or stealing from them and that kind of thing. You want it to be a relationship that's an equal partnership mm-hmm. with your bird.
That's something I need to work on even with my bird. Continually.
Well, I
mantle a little.
I don't know a whole lot about hawks because I haven't flown a lot of hawks since I've only flown falcons.
I think they tend to mantle a little more.
I don't have a lot of experience in training and hunting mm-hmm. with like a red tail or a goshawk. You know, I just can't help comparing because
with what we saw today, and then with my hawks or with the hawks that I've worked with, I'm seeing similarities and differences.
Yeah.
And so it's a neat comparison, and I love how different it is from flying long wings to, you know, the broad wings.
Yeah.
And I know there's even a difference between like the Budios, like the Harris's and red-tailed hawks compared to the accipiters.
Well, it must be
interesting to see all the differences.
I don't know if there's a little I don't know if there's a little bit of long wing envy in you guys that hunt rabbits, because I know everybody kind of talks kind of like, wouldn't it be cool if I could soar my hawk and it would hunt out of a soar?
Yeah,
my hawk will do that.
Get you a falcon.
Yeah,
but if you really want to hunt like that, you should get a falcon, I think.
So, you know, but it is cool. It's fun to see a falcon leave your fist and power into the sky, and you know it's climbing up there into the sky in anticipation of stooping on the quarry that you're going to flush for it. It's a real exciting way to hunt. I think it's, you know, one of the coolest ways.
And I've seen that even on posts through social media. I'll post a video of my hawk soaring, and they're like, hurry, flush some game so you get it. Only if my hawk would hunt from a soar. And I was thinking that too, and I was like, isn't that more of a falcon thing?
why don't you just hunt with some falcons?
Yeah,
I mean, even you guys, you'll admit you'd like to see your bird stoop out of a soar and nail a rabbit. And people want to do it with eagles and everything else, but you know, it's because seeing a that's one of the most spectacular things in nature is to see a bird of prey stoop. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you can manufacture that in your falconry, that makes for a real exciting falconry. The stoop is definitely a cool thing to see.
Mm-hmm. That definitely is. I also wanted to ask, because recently I got introduced into falconry kind of through the bird show you used to do. Almost five years ago is when I first saw the bird show that you used to do at the Hogle Zoo, and it was so unfortunate that this year that show is completely closed down.
Yeah.
The World of Flight.
Never again will they have one there. It's sad.
It was
enjoyable. I did it for 25 years, and everything has to come to an end. I guess I was, you know, I would have done it till another 10 years, but it was a lot of work, and mm-hmm. I'm enjoying the freedom now. But it was heartbreaking to tear it down, and but.
Yeah, when I saw the theater, it's just dusty and dirty, and things brought down, and I'd like shed a tear walking by that the amphitheater.
It was a wonderful thing we had for mm-hmm. a long, long time there. It was a tradition at the zoo that will, I'm sure, be missed by many, and mm-hmm. I miss it. And
people are saying the zoo's just not the same anymore.
No, yeah.
so many people love that bird show. It's sad that it
came to this, but it's and it could have been worked out, and we could have could have figured it out. I would have like kept the birds there and not even, you know, taken any money, just if we had a place to keep them and, you know,
and show them and just do some education.
Just to get through this pandemic, you know.
Yeah.
And because I know the zoo's not bringing in a lot of people, so, you know, we could have done on a skeleton crew and kept it, but they There was more to it than just the pandemic. The zoo wanted to get rid of the bird show because it was so popular that they knew there would be a huge outcry, and the COVID-19 pandemic was a
kind of
perfect
made the
reason for them to say we can't do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's fine.
That is unfortunate. But you're enjoying retirement now.
I am enjoying it.
I'm enjoying it.
And I miss some of the birds we had. And mm-hmm. It's like, you know,
some local falconers actually got some of your birds, and they were having some success with them too. Like one of your Harrises that you sold out named Jack. He was having some success hunting rabbits. That was really cool to see.
Yeah. Anyway, well,
they called him Showbird Jack all the time, and he was catching rabbits. I thought it was amazing. Yeah, why don't you go ahead and plug in where people can find you on YouTube?
You can go to my YouTube channel. It's just Steve. This is probably, you'll never remember this. Steve Chingren is my YouTube channel, but just scratch your chin and grin, and you'll remember. Steve Chingren.
Chingren. I'll also put a link for your channel in the description so you guys can easily find it. But you're planning on inviting more people out to the House of Grouse, from what I hear.
Well, you know, once we get over this COVID virus, but right now we're trying to keep it down because, you know, it's going crazy. So anybody that comes up right now, we're asking them to get a COVID test before they come. And it's been a real slow year this year because of that. So in the future, we may have, you know, guests here, but we got to get through this pandemic. Yeah.
So I'll also include a link for Steve's website where you can email him and talk about if you're really interested in coming to the House of Grouse, that could be an option for you. And I'll put a link to the website there. Again, right now you said it's pretty slow.
The link is
we kind of get over the whole coronavirus thing, hopefully things will pick up and we can get some people out here.
Towards spring, I'm
learning, you know, and watching your falcons fly or doing photography.
It's mainly going to be for doing photography.
Photography.
And viewing wildlife and not so much the falconry.
Okay.
So the season's when people will come to do that. But if people want to come and see falconry, They could do that as well, but it'd be on a very small scale. We usually don't like more than, you know, two to four guests.
But thank you so much for
You're welcome.
Willing to sit down and have me out here. This was a dream come true.
Well, that concludes episode 1 of the Wilderness Wonders podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today, and don't forget to subscribe, like, check out our other social media for more wildlife and falconry content. Thank you guys so much, and we'll see you next time.